This case is In Re Trust of Turner and Mr. Sprague. You may approach.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is J.L. Sprague. I'm appearing today on behalf of Barry Turner, the appellant here, and the petitioner in the county court. A few key dates and facts are important, and unfortunately, from reading the court's order, it'd be almost impossible to figure out what happened. You have to delve into the transcript and the Bill of Exceptions. But in July of 2012, the settler removed the co-trustees and replaced them with an individual trustee, a third party. In 2016, the original action was brought by Mr. Turner to remove the successor trustee. Arguably in retaliation for that, the settler in June of 2016 removed Mr. Turner as a beneficiary of the trust. And then in his second action, or amended petition, which addressed both the issue of the trustee and the removal of the beneficiary on testamentary intent and capacity, the court unilaterally, without notice and hearing, appointed a guardian ad litem. The guardian ad litem came back and reported to the court that her condition was so good that she wasn't subject to a mental examination, and the court denied a subsequent motion for a mental examination in January of 2017. Now, the parties agree, and I think the court agreed, that this matter's tried under the Uniform Trust Code, which I may have biffed on a few citations, I'll admit in the brief, but it's in Chapter 30, Section 3801 at SEC. And the matter has seven assignments of error, but generally they all go to one plain error on the record, which was the appointment of the guardian ad litem.
And you acknowledge that we'd have to reach this on a plain error standard, because there was no objection at any point as it relates to the GAL, the report, anything else.
And right? I'm aware of that, Judge Welchin. And really, I understand the plain error, and of course we briefed it in the rebuttal, and the court has authority to exercise our assignment of error under the plain error theory. But the chance to object to the appointment of the GAL didn't occur because there was no hearing on it. So there was a unilateral motion to appoint a guardian ad litem. The court, without any authority whatsoever to do so under the trust code, appointed the guardian ad litem ex parte, without a hearing, without notice. And then the guardian ad litem started to act not only as the eyes and ears of the court, as is the traditional point of a guardian ad litem, but went out and appeared as counsel, filed their report of record, which unfortunately was treated as evidence by the court, polluting the whole case all the way through, including all the procedural motions that followed. And then, two openings, two closings, two cross-examinations. It was an active guardian ad litem who sat and participated in the trial and in fact made objections that counsel, the lady had counsel, didn't make. So it poisoned the entire proceeding and everything that follows from that decision to appoint the guardian ad litem and give her status under section or chapter 30, section 42, the guardian ad litem statutes, giving her that unbridled authority to basically present evidence without cross-examination, without any real opportunity to even confront her, and then the court relied on it all. That's the part. At each step, the court cites the guardian ad litem's report as the basis for the court's decision.
So does the court have equitable authority to appoint a GAL in this type of situation?
So in 2016, the legislature does a couple things. It passes the Uniform Trust Code, which specifically says, let me see if I'm doing this right, it passes the guardian statute, chapter 40, or section 42, which specifically ties only to the probate code, which then when it passed the Uniform Trust Code, is not part of the Uniform Probate Code for purposes of appointing a GAL. And I apologize, I hope I wrote that better in the brief than I just said it, but it's a little complicated, but that's the root of the issue. Did the court even have authority to do this?
Right.
And I know your question, I'm going to get to it, but let me further explain that in the Uniform Trust Code, it specifically defines guardian to exclude guardian ad litem.
So there's really no provision in the Uniform Trust Code to appoint a guardian ad litem. So does the court have equitable power to appoint, or inherent power to appoint a guardian ad litem? Well, they have up until now. Did the legislature take that away by all the detail they put in these two sections of the Chapter 30? Maybe up to you.
Yeah, out of the gate, though, in that statute, they say that the point of that statute is to expand the role of the guardian ad litem. But doesn't that suggest that the equitable power still exists?
And they absolutely did expand the role of the guardian ad litem by giving them all the authority to go out and investigate and to bring it all back to court as if it's admissible evidence. But what it applies to is the key. Does all that power apply to the Uniform Trust Code? I don't think it does. I think the code's pretty, the guardian ad litem statute's very clear that those statutes only apply to the probate code, which is explicitly defined by sections in Chapter 30 and excludes the Uniform Trust Code. So there was no authority for the court to do it. It was as if the court didn't have jurisdiction.
So under the statutory, the 2016 new guardianship statute, I think on its face, it applies to guardianships, conservatorships, and protective proceedings. That's a statutory guardian ad litem. But the equitable power of a court, that still applies, does it not? And doesn't the Uniform Trust Code incorporate the notions of the equity into the code itself?
To the extent that the legislature doesn't limit or define it. And I think you're right, the court has equitable powers unless the statute ties its hands, which in this case it does by the fact that the guardian ad litem statute is limited in what it can be applied to, and it's exclusive of the Uniform Trust Code. So again, I'm probably not articulating this very well because it's sort of a trail you have to follow to get to the answer, but the conclusion is that there was no, certainly no statutory authority and maybe a statutory prohibition for the court appointing a GAL under Section 42 with all that power. Now, whether the court had authority, inherent authority under its equitable powers, and the probate court sitting has equitable powers, I agree with that, then does the court have the power to expand that traditional eyes of the court role and give them a seat at counsel table, give them cross-examination, objection power, power to just fiat their evidence. I see that I'm reserved for my rebuttal time, but thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fisher?
Good morning, Your Honors. David Fisher with Dunmer, Fisher, Hastings & Pauley from Hastings, Nebraska, representing Mrs. Turner, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Spray raises the guardian ad litem issue, and the court has asked a number of policy questions and inclusions and exclusions, and I guess where the appellant is coming from is the long and fast rule that you had all the opportunity in the world to object and have this matter determined by the trial court, and you stood moot. The Nebraska Supreme Court recently just reaffirmed all of the points in our brief in Ecker v. ENA Consulting Group, Inc. They ruled failure to make a timely objection waives the right to assert prejudicial error on appeal.
But the court, we still have the ability under a plain error review if it reaches the level of plain error.
Absolutely. But in this particular case, I don't believe the plain error rule provides a reason to abandon the standard rule of the court. Michelle Odom was appointed guardian ad litem by the court.
Under what authority?
Pardon?
Under what authority did the court?
I think at that point I would have to say probably under the equitable authority of the court, Your Honor. This new statute was was adopted in April. The order was entered in September. I doubt seriously if any of us had any express knowledge of that statute sitting there. However, that kind of reinforces the point that if an objection had been raised, we'd all had that statute in front of us and we had all argued it, and we would have all properly had the court make an affirmative determination of the scope and the applicability of that statute in our proceeding.
So if the court was appointing the GAL under equitable authority, what are the parameters of the GAL's duties?
Well, that's an interesting question, Your Honor. Quite frankly, you know, I requested appointment, and the court immediately appointed Ms. Odom as guardian ad litem. I assumed there were going to be a report, as generally happens in a GAL situation. I show up at a hearing, Ms. Odom is there, and I get depositions, and Ms. Odom is there, and we go to final hearing, and Ms. Odom is there. I have no control, had no control over Ms. Odom. The court obviously felt comfortable with her assuming whatever obligation she felt she had as a guardian ad litem. And I think there is statutory and judicial authority that says a guardian ad litem can be an affirmative representative. Now, whether you need two at a hearing, I don't know, but that wasn't my call to make. And again, the appellant had every opportunity through this total proceeding to raise the issue of Ms. Odom's authority and scope of authority through hearings, through depositions. At any time, a simple motion would have brought this question to the court. Likewise, the fact of her appointment, a simple motion at any point saying, Judge, I don't think she's supposed to be here, would have put the whole thing on the table, and we would have given Judge Mead the opportunity to fully address that issue.
Would you concede that after appointment during the course of these proceedings, then, that the guardian ad litem actually served the role as an advocate in addition to being a guardian ad litem?
I don't think there's any question, Your Honor. Yes, she was an advocate.
Didn't the Supreme
Court? Now, I'm not so sure that she was an advocate, but I wouldn't say that she was expressly representing Mrs. Turner.
She cross-examined at trial, didn't she?
Pardon?
She cross-examined at trial.
She cross-examined at trial, yes, she did.
Filed pleadings in connection with the proceedings?
She filed no pleadings except for her guardian ad litem report.
Well, what about the objection that she filed in connection
Oh,
with
on the mental examination.
Yeah, mental
yes, assessment. Okay, yes,
exactly.
You're right.
Yeah, acting in dual roles. Didn't the Supreme Court in 1999 say once a guardian ad litem is appointed, they don't serve that role as a counselor? If you need a counselor, you go and get one.
Yes, I believe that probably is the rule. Then the question is, how is that rule enforced, and when should it be enforced?
That's my question. Is that plain error?
I don't believe it is. You have plain error. You have to look at the totality of what happened in this proceeding. And the long and short of it is, Judge Mead ruled that the appellant failed to meet his burden of proof in both of the questions that were before the court, as far as the fitness of the trustee and the competency of Mrs. Turner to make that amendment in 2006. There was no evidence during that entire hearing that was excluded based upon an objection by me or Ms. Odom. Every item of evidence that was offered by the appellant at that hearing was accepted and went into evidence. There was just nothing that would have changed. I sit here and say, well, I carried most of the water in this case. and Ms. Odom was at my back. I can't deny that. That wasn't by my direction or choice. But I, in the big picture, there wasn't plain error, because what she didn't change or wouldn't change the outcome, and Judge Mead's opinion was proper and correct. Appellant would seem to indicate that my judge takes everything verbatim that Ms. Odom may have presented to him in her report. Well, two things. No, he's a very good judge, and he knows how to separate the wheat from the chaff. And again, if that appellant had it within his reach to keep that report out of the record, the hearsay, I think the Supreme Court is very clear that you can't sidestep the hearsay rule with a guardian ad litem report. However, again, we never gave Judge Mead the opportunity to look at that issue. So I don't see plain error. I do see the failure of the appellant to raise objections all along during this entire proceeding. And it isn't as if there wasn't experienced lawyers involved. I had a greater Nebraska lawyer in this matter. And so I would just respectfully suggest that, yes, the rule guardian ad litem might change, but it doesn't change the outcome of this case.
One quick question, just with regard to the record. You said Ms. Oldham objected to the request to have your client evaluated.
Right.
Did you also object?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
And, well, I won't get into the reason why the mental exam even came into being. That's a whole different story, so, no.
Any other questions?
Any?
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Spray?
Time left.
How much time do we have left? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I wasn't there, and I didn't meet Mr. Fisher till this morning, just to be clear. I think, first of all, we probably ought to look at what plain error is. It has to be evident from the record, and the record's replete with it. It has to prejudicially affect someone's rights, and I think the rights of confrontation, the rights of having a trial conducted according to the rules in an orderly fashion with the proper parties appearing is a valuable right that any litigant should have. And does it cause damage to the integrity, reputation, and fairness of the judicial system? That's really the question here. And I'm not too proud of the judge's order in this case. It's a mess. The penultimate order doesn't state facts correctly, doesn't even frame the issues from the pleadings correctly. It misstates what everybody's at court for. And in fact, it does rely on the guardian ad litem's report, as did all of the previous procedural orders. And there's no question that that is plain error. Now the question is, what can we do about it? I don't know the strategy of counsel for appellant at trial. It may be that they didn't want to make the judge mad because the judge had made that decision, and we're just going to live with it. But it was an ex parte decision made without notice and hearing to appoint a guardian ad litem without reference to under what provision or what authority they were going to have, and then that guardian ad litem ran amok. And the gatekeeper, all that, frankly, should be the judge. The judge should be the one, because that person was acting on the judge's behalf, if under that inherent power, for the judge and not for any of the litigants. The irony, of course, the irony of the whole case is that the guardian ad litem, who arguably gets appointed because there's a question of competency, concludes there is competency, and then objects to the mental exam, but continues in the case because supposedly she's there to protect the litigant because they may be incompetent after establishing, it just doesn't make any sense. And that's the point when really the plain error starts to affect the rights of the parties and has to be addressed. I don't want to leave the podium without talking about the assignment of error on the fees, because I hope the court can see the unfairness of turning around and making my client pay for the guardian ad litem who acted as counsel against him in a case without authority of the statute or really without authority of the court.
But I looked at that in the order has paid the guardian ad litem fees, not the guardian ad litem's attorney fees, right?
Well, the guardian ad litem racked up a pretty big bill. I don't remember the number from the record. It's there because there was a subsequent hearing on it, but it was $20,000 or $30,000. So attending all of those depositions and sitting through all those hearings and attending the trial and all that did add up to quite a big number for the guardian ad litem's bill.
Right.
And if the court had authority to appoint a guardian ad litem, the court also has authority to assess
I think that's probably hand in hand, but I think in this case it was error to pay the fees for all the work the guardian ad litem did beyond the scope of what the court had power to grant the guardian ad litem to do. I'm out of time, and thank you very much. This was
thank
a nice
you,
day.
Mr. Spence.
Okay.
All right, the case will be taken under submission, and parties are excused.